Listen for Insight, a podcast from Miami University's Lockheed Martin Leadership Institute dedicated to spreading ideas of creativity, innovation, and leadership. Welcome to Listen for Insight. I'm your host, David Turnick. We have for you Glenn Platt, the director of the Armstrong Interactive Media Studies Institute at Miami University, and his insights on higher education and the creativity needed to change it. I send you now to our interviewer, Sierra Gooden.
Hi, everybody. My name is Sierra Gooden. I am a junior at Miami University, and today I have the pleasure of interviewing the director of the Armstrong Interactive Media Studies Department at Miami University. His name is Glenn Platt. Glenn, welcome.
Thank you.
My first question for you is going to be, you have been the director for the last 16 years. What departmental programs or initiatives are you most proud of, and what vision do you have for the future of the department?
You know, what I think I'm most proud of is, I think back on the past 16 years, is the group of people that we've assembled to help make the program a reality. That the faculty and staff that we have are superb, right? And, you know, and I know you asked me specifically about programs, but I think at the end of the day, universities are really about people more than programs, and that if you design them right, the programs evolve and change, but the people, you know, don't, hopefully. And so what I'm most proud of is the team that we've assembled. You know, that we have faculty who are experts in design, faculty who are experts in e-commerce and digital business, faculty who are leaders in games and games and learning, you know, in a variety of different places in which technology is sort of helping to advance business and design frontiers.
Absolutely. To follow up on that, what role do you think the internet does play in post-secondary education? What can other educators from other departments be doing to acknowledge that role to better teach the students?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, Sierra. I think, well, higher education in general has been changing really at sort of a snail's pace. If you think back to sort of the 1800s and that original German model for higher education that today really still exists, very little has changed. And what's happened with the advent of the internet and sort of related networking technologies has been in some sense like the sand underneath being shifted much quicker than it ever had before.
Right.
And you know, I think higher education's been a bit slow to realize it, to be honest. I think they've been able to coast to some extent on a lot of their energy they've had up to this point in time. They've been successful. There are sort of legacy effects and institutional effects. You know, there's a metaphor I use sometimes when talking about this, and it's not my metaphor, actually. Daniel Quinn first coined it, but I think it's really appropriate. he talks about how the early experimenters with flight, if you've ever seen like those old black and white movies, these people who had these machines that flapped up and down with their arms or little things that spun around over their heads, and they would sort of get speed going down a ramp and then kind of go off an edge of a cliff and then start flapping, and that there's this period of time when you're not sure if you're falling or flying. And where higher education is right now with respect to the internet, I would argue that we're falling, but we're so far from the ground, we don't see it yet, right? Like there's a sense that, oh, we must be flying, and all we need to do in response to all this new internet stuff is just flap harder, right? And spin the things over our heads faster. but the reality is that the game has changed completely. Like there is not one thing that I got $20 right now. I'm going to put on the table for you. $20 that says there's not one thing that you've learned in a class this year at Miami University that is not available. That information is not available for free on the internet. Not one thing. There's not one class you've had where you've sat there and someone has told you something that you couldn't otherwise know, right? And I'm not sure higher ed totally gets that, right? That the model it was built on, you know, prior to your birth, when people wanted to know something, there was actually relatively few people who knew it,
right?
I mean, sometimes I talk to my son and I try to get him to understand that, and it's almost inconceivable to the new generation that, for example, when I was, even when I was your age, if I wanted to know, like, what was the capital of Uzbekistan, that would take a considerable amount of effort on my part. Like, it was a non-trivial amount of effort. I would need to go to a library. Maybe I could call somebody, but odds are I'd probably actually have to go somewhere. And so universities, it made sense for them to be these repositories of information. You would go and there would be, you know, that classic picture of a professor you have in your head with the patches on the elbows, smoking a pipe, who, when you say, tell me, who is, you know, where is the capital of Uzbekistan, they would tell you that.
Right.
So knowledge was, you know, one of my colleagues refers to it as the difference between a stock and a flow, and that knowledge was a stock. It was like a thing that would get sort of pushed into people's heads, and when you needed to get it, you'd go find those people, and they would pull it out and give it to you. But what the internet changed was it made knowledge more of a flow variable, that knowledge is just all out there. It's all moving past us. And so the game isn't trying to find people who have it stuck in their head, who will pull it out standing in front of a room while you're taking notes, but rather how do you tap into that flow of information that's floating all around you. You know, you could picture, you know, the end of the Matrix, right? And all those digits that are around you, and knowing which ones to pull to get that information. That's kind of what the game is now. But universities aren't designed for that. Universities are designed for the person in the front of the room who has all of the knowledge. And so the upshot of that is that our jobs as professors has shifted from being repositories of information to instead being experience designers, that my job is to curate an experience where you're going to tap into the right sort of internet-based information or database, or it might not even be the internet, but sort of technology-driven opportunities and experiences. And so in interactive media studies, you know, what we've tried to do as we've designed this program and built it is to make it more of an academic program situated for the 21st century, where our faculty, back to your first question, they're not here because they know everything there is to know about something, but rather they are superb guides and curators of experiences for you, so that when you come to Miami, it isn't about somebody saying the very same thing you could learn from the internet in a classroom, but rather somebody who says, hey, Sierra, you know, let's spend time having you figure out how to design and run your own podcast as a way to help prepare you for understanding your future in public discourse, as opposed to standing in a room and reading about Marshall McLuhan and some kind of theory that, you know, is certainly important and valid, but there's no reason you need to be paying $30,000 a year for it.
Right. That's excellent. Thank you. I want to move it a little bit into your professional and personal experiences.
Sure.
What are maybe some key moments where you have been challenged to think creatively or think out of the box to solve a problem? And how do you think that worked out for you?
Well, I mean, in keeping with our theme, I think the challenge for me in thinking creatively has been around building interactive media studies. That, you know, we all recognized back in 1995 when we started interactive media studies, we recognized that this was a new type of academic pursuit, that it wasn't a classic discipline like, say, physics, you know, where you have kind of a body of knowledge and you build on it and you become an expert in physics, that instead this thing that was starting to change the world, and we were the first program in the country that taught interactive media, this thing required this breadth of understanding. It required understanding in business and design and code and psychology and writing and communication, aesthetics, and, you know, potentially a host of other disciplines like history. And that universities were not designed for that. So the creative challenge was, so then how do you do that, right? How do you make a program, as we are, that is not in any academic unit? We're not in business or arts and science or creative arts or any of the colleges. We're in all of them. And so sometimes we talk about interactive media studies a bit like people talk about light, like we're either a wave or a particle depending on how you look at it. And we're kind of like a department, and we're kind of like an academic division, depends on how you look at it. And so we've had to create all kinds of new processes. So not to get like too in the woods about how higher ed works, right? But even something as profound, I think, for higher ed as promotion and tenure becomes really complex for us. So the old university model, you've got a department, you get hired as a professor into that department, and then to some extent the name of the game is about getting promotion and tenure. You get 6 years, and either you're fired at the end of 6 years or you've got a job for life, right? You know, assuming you don't kill anybody. The way you get promoted and tenured traditionally at a university is that the members of your department vote on that promotion and tenure. But what my faculty do, what we all do, is transdisciplinary. It's not really in a department. And interactive media studies isn't a department because we're not in any of the colleges at Miami. So what we've had to do is create promotion and tenure by contract. So, for example, Bob DeShooter, one of our fabulous professors who does work on games and aging and how old people play games. So by old people, he means like people my age. When he comes up for promotion and tenure, even though he's technically in the College of Education, you wouldn't want him to be just judged by a bunch of education professors.
Right, exactly.
They just know the education stuff, which is great. But you'd also want someone who understands the coding he did and the computer science side of it. And you'd want someone who knows the design part and the gerontology part, right? And traditional university structures don't allow for that. And so we've had to create a new promotion and tenure process where we have contracts that define interdisciplinary promotion and tenure committees that help him continue to do what he needs to do. That's just like one example. So for us, that's creative.
Very
bureaucratic and arcane, but we've had to be really creative about the structures that universities have designed so that we can make things work here.
Yeah.
Which is part of the fun.
It sounds fun. Very creative, very innovative. And speaking of creativity and innovation, Glenn Platt is also playing a huge role in Miami Ideas, which is a moniker used to reference the Year of Creativity and Innovation. Anyone looking for more information on that can go to miamioh.edu/Miami Ideas. And so, Glenn, I wanted to ask, what is your perspective on the purpose of Miami Ideas, and what is the scope? Is it changing? Is it getting smaller? What's happening there?
Well, the purpose for Miami Ideas was to do two things. You know, first, it was to highlight what a creative and innovative institution Miami is. Because I think externally, our look and feel belies that a little bit. Like, if you were to walk on campus, the buildings are very traditional, right? The students are fairly traditional looking, right? I mean, it's a very classic, like, people say that if you thought about what a college would look like in the movies, this is it. Right, which is great, but you would not sort of look at it and think, oh, well, this is a hotbed of innovation, right? There aren't people walking around the quad, you know, with jetpacks and doing the things sort of at least visibly that you would associate with creativity and innovation. But if you just peel back the surface a little bit and look underneath it all, this is an amazingly innovative institution. You know, we've been the first to do all sorts of, I think, exciting and innovative things. Ames being certainly one of them, but by no means is the most important or sort of the most impactful. The university has a long history of being innovative. Its faculty, its students, its staff. And so we wanted to celebrate that. We wanted to create some mechanism to share the cool stuff we've got going on here, which is awesome. Then the second thing we wanted to do was to help the university build a little bit of kind of tailwind towards becoming even more innovative and creative, and to set in motion something that would last long beyond the Year of Creativity and Innovation that would allow us to continue moving down that path. So we're working to build what's called a Creativity and Innovation Toolkit, which will be this online living document repository of creativity and innovation tips and tricks and tools and objects and things and videos. We're doing everything from working to have a creativity and innovation RV to creativity and innovation fellows that are coming and spending a whole year talking about these issues. As you know, at the graduation this year, we've got Sir Ken Robinson coming to talk about innovation and creativity. We began the year with the folks from Second City talking about how improvisation is a way to help build creative and innovative capacity. And so we wanted to try to pull out some of that and create the mechanisms for people to keep talking about creativity and innovation.
So speaking of Miami ideas and all of these different styles of communication you have had to leverage, and you did reference that it was a surprise to you how easy it was for everyone to talk to each other. What else surprised you about this process?
You know, the thing that surprised me the most, I think it's my greatest takeaway from the Miami Ideas experience, has been how suddenly simply giving permission to be creative has just pulled people out of the woodwork. Like, I keep hearing stories, for example, there was one unit on campus that was having their annual retreat. And instead of their usual annual, you know, let's talk about our mission and what our goals are for the year, you know, they did this really creative, like, scavenger hunt thing and role-playing exercise. Like, it's just allowed people to be a little more, you know, I don't want to, I'm repeating it when I say be more creative, but it's just be more open about how they approach problems and how they think about what they do in their jobs. Which I think is awesome, and I think it's fantastic, and that's everything that we had hoped would happen. And what I really hope continues, though, is this sense of permission to be creative. Like, if there was only one lesson I could say I would hope people take away from the year of creativity and innovation, is that we are always given permission to be creative and innovative. You don't need a year. You don't need your boss to say it. You know, you don't need, you know, a call for proposals. That creativity and innovation, you know, is always one of the cards that you have in your hand, like always. And if we can somehow help the university adjust more that way, so that it's not just let's do something weird for our annual retreat because it's this year, but let's just do this always. Or, you know, next year let's do something totally different. Let's all do one of those, what are those rooms where they lock you in and you got to try to get out?
Escape the rooms,
right?
Yeah.
Like, let's do that for our retreat. You know, that kind of thinking, we hope, continues. So that to me, is both the most surprising thing, which is that people felt they needed that permission, but I think also the most promising thing, that if we can keep that sensibility alive, I think it could have a profound impact. My name is Glenn Platt. Thank you for listening for Insight.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Listen for Insight, a part of Miami Ideas. Tune in next time for more insights on creativity, innovation, and leadership. Siesta by Jazar is licensed under an attribution share alike.